Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Alex Thuma and Ken Thomas. Alex is the founder and CEO of SaaStalk, Europe's largest B2B SaaS community, bringing together founders, investors and operators to accelerate growth and knowledge sharing. After building SaaStalk into a global phenomenon, with conferences across multiple continents and a thriving founder community, he launched Back Future Ventures, a B2B SaaS-focused venture capital fund to leverage his deep sector insights and network to back the next generation of software innovators. Joining Alex is Ken Thomas, principal at Back Future Ventures, whose experience spans traditional banking in New York and London, fintech partnerships, and early-stage B2B SaaS investing. Ken brings operational rigor and strategic thinking to the partnership, shaped by his experiences navigating fintech scale-ups and financial innovation. In today's episode, we talk about building a network being crucial to building a VC firm.
You need to have built a network over 10 years. And I felt like the timing that we anticipated, so like we started just over a year ago, like with Back Future, that was the right time. 7 years ago would have been too early.
How VC is as qualitative as it is quantitative.
A lot of it is how you gel with someone, how can you, manage expectations and have conversations that could be open and honest, but not unfair.
Raising a fund on the brink of the SVB collapse and on the evolution of SaaS. Is it really dead?
I think in the beginning, there was very much a coupling of the SaaStalk brand with the Back Future brand. Yeah. But as we've kind of progressed this new deck, we're kind of decoupling it a bit to say, okay, like, this is standalone, but the USP is still there.
How AI is the technology while SaaS is the business model, and on the fatigue of virtual events in a world that wants face-to-face.
It became like overwhelming. There was 100 virtual events every day. So people got sick of it. And we realized that the real value, nothing beats face-to-face, right?
Let's get straight into it. Alex, Ken, really great to have you in the studio. Thank you for joining me. It's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for likewise.
Amazing. Well, look, let's jump straight in. So let's talk about this kind of evolution of SaaStalk from kind of community to capital. So you've gone from building SaaStalk to Back Future. So you spent almost a decade building SaaStalk from a blog and a podcast into kind of the premier SaaS community in Europe. What point did you realize that transitioning into VC was the natural next step? And how did your mindset shift from that kind of community builder to investor? And then given both of your unique backgrounds, how do you see community-driven VC models evolving? And do you think this is now becoming more of the new standard for early stage investing?
Yeah, good question. So, it's something that I've been encouraged to do, I think, for the best part of 7 years. And I think 7 years ago, it would have been too early. And I've heard, and I'm sure you've heard before, that when launching a VC, certainly like one of the paths and suggestions is that you need to have built a network over 10 years. And I have now, done that. I'm in my 10th year. And it's a pretty solid network, right? So I felt like the timing and we anticipated, so like we started just over a year ago, like with Back Future, that was the right time. 7 years ago would have been too early and would probably have like failed compared to where we are now. But I think like also it was like post-COVID and 2022 when the fire really lit in my belly as to like this is what I really want to do in a coexistence with the SaaStalk world, but also in a post-SaaStalk world. This is like where I want to be in 20 years' time. Mm. And I don't necessarily want to be the CEO of SaaStalk in 20 years' time, or perhaps, hand over the reins to somebody else. I want SaaStalk still to be around, at that point. So I think it was a couple of years ago and driven by a lot of encouragement, driven by my own curiosity to learn and develop further, learn something new, learn by doing. I'd never built a community or a conference before. How did I do it? I just kind of learned by doing. And
just
I often
did
find,
it.
I often find that that's the best way, right? Yeah. So I think that was it. And I was just kind of really, then when we look at like, what did SaaStalk provide to our community, right? We really helped predominantly founders and, from inception to exit, we could say cradle to grave, but it's probably a bit more of a negative connotation there. But really from having that idea or, spawning the idea, from being inspired at SaaStalk, right? So getting the capital from other investors at SaaS.org through learning the playbooks, learning how to take that next step, and even then connecting them with M&A and PE and so on. What we didn't have was actually providing capital ourselves. And I think
So let me just dig into that for a second, right? So the question I would pose is, and I guess you could you know, you could take whatever line you could look at this from two different angles, but how does building a community, I get, right? And obviously you are seeing these businesses at the community. And therefore you have the deal flow side of it, right? I get that, right? That's clear. You have potentially even the co-investment side of it, right? Because you also have VCs and angels and others. But from the perspective of which one of these is going to work, how were you able to build the conviction that you would be able to have the conviction to take bets on some of these businesses? Because I would assume, like, you know, at an event, you're going to see the best of the best, right? You're going to see the ones that are certainly, at least from a media perspective, are kind of riding high and they're out there in the press. But how do you pick that pre-seed, you know, that founder that sat in the audience kind of really scribbling notes away versus the big, you know, because you're not investing in the bigger guys. You're not investing at those later stages. So how did that translation work for you?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, right? And I think the, like, a big part of the art is in the picking, but, like, ultimately we're placing a lot of bets, right? And we are, you know, with the power law, hoping that a couple of them actually work. What I would say is that, given that I've probably spoken to and met more SaaS companies than most, over the years,
just one or two.
over the years, I think I've always had a good eye for, like, a good eye or a sense for picking, like, what company is, like, or what product is really hot and, like, you know, and seeing them take off, right? And being almost like this early adopter and given my exposure and involvement within that, and I've had feedback around that. But what I would say is that when we look at it like now, as to, okay, we're first time investors, and, like, it's not this like, you know, magic wand that we have or special power that we have. What we do have is a great network, and we're speaking to the network, right? That includes all of our LPs as well, right? We have a process, right? We're looking at certain indicators, right? But ultimately, we're placing bets. But what we're doing, when I think about the this 10-year network that we've built, and where we're seeing some of the opportunities that I think, let's say somebody, if they didn't have that network work and built what we built with SaaS.org, would come into VC and try to replicate, is that because of the value that we've added, because of the relationships that I have, we're getting opportunities, and certainly now, not all of the deals that we've done 13, but for instance, one of the deals that we've done is, you know, one of the co-founders of WalkMe, he took the company public. He's now chairman of, you know, the second company, I think they're out of stealth now. You know, and they did a safe round led by Mangrove Capital and a lot of, like, what I would call, you know, like, top tier strategics in there. And they wanted, you know, he wanted me to come in because of, like, my relationship with him and so on. And we've had other examples, right? And so where these would be very hot competitive deals, but perhaps because of the relationship, because of the currency that I've built over years, that we're getting access to. And I think, like, a lot of tier two, tier three VCs, perhaps would not be able to do that.
So maybe, Ken, a question for you then, right? Because you don't come from the SaaS.org side of things. Okay, you were in journalism. But so I guess two questions, right? Like, do all the deals you look at come via SaaS.org? Or has it broadened out beyond that? And then what are your thoughts on this kind of community-led VC sort of transition? Because it feels like, you know, we're seeing more and more, and we certainly saw more and more during the kind of 19, 20, 21 years. It seemed like a lot of VCs the way they were able to build their funds or the way they were able to raise their capital was by nature of having 50,000 followers on Twitter or 100,000 followers on LinkedIn or whatever the numbers might look like. What's your take? So do you think that these community-driven VC models are here to stay and will evolve? And do you think that's kind of becoming a more of a standard at early stage? And obviously, as I mentioned, like, I think what will be interesting is when the deals start coming through to you, and presumably they already are, but come through to you beyond SaaStock, right? Where you actually are just seen for being, you know, the go-to at early stage for these sort of deals.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to see how the channels have kind of refined over time. So like if we're targeting, for instance, 36 deals for the fund, we say we have, like I said, Dublin and Austin, which we have two pitch competitions there, like all things good, we invest in the winner. So that's 6 out of 36 are at that point. You know, you mentioned with the LP one we had with Rafael Sueri, there's another one we did out of Spain, there's another one we did out of the US that came via like that SaaStock network, where they very clearly, like, they had their lead, took most of the round, and it's like it's up to the founder who they want on there. So like I said, there's a lot of currency there. We haven't lost many deals that we really wanted to get into, but I think for the amount of equity and capital we take out of a round, to have a distribution channel that is SaaStock, it makes a lot of sense. So it's very, in the beginning, I guess we as we started implementing our processes, a lot to learn there. We have.
Do you have on your term sheets that SaaStock will promote like portfolio companies of Back Future?
Yeah, well, there's, I guess, portfolio support is something we've refined over time, like make sure they have booths, make sure they're having the right meetings and things like that. I think as we've kind of gone on, we've seen that as they kind of progress through their life cycle, having those speaking opportunities, getting earned media as well makes a lot of sense. I mean, we've had one of our portfolio companies that won the pitch competition that helped their round a lot. And then they went on the SaaS Revolution podcast that Alex has. That's kind of refined it a lot. I think from the community-driven aspect, when I left the last company I worked for, which is, you know, FinTech, I have been through, like, you know, every aspect of the commercial or org. I've ended up on partnerships, and that really taught me a lot about what it means to, how long it takes to build those things, what it actually means, leading with value. What I've found interesting is in VC, despite how, I guess it all comes down to a transaction or two, hopefully the one you initially invest in and the one you actually get your capital back from. A lot of this is very qualitative. A lot of it is how you gel with someone. How can you, you know, manage expectations and have conversations that aren't, that could be open and honest, but not like unfair, I guess, if that makes sense. So that's been kind of there. So as myself moving into it, I've always chose, if you're doing, you know, 1 to 3 deals a quarter, how many founders, how many people are going to be meeting during that period that can provide value to, like, making those connections that to myself wouldn't cost me anything but could help people in my network that knows, and that kind of develops on itself, which, you know, kind of ties into the SaaStock ecosystem as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the point that's coming out is community can be the driver. It can even be the source. But over time, it becomes more than that. It becomes distribution channel. It becomes it becomes a testing ground, I guess, right, for some of the earlier stage businesses. But it also is exactly as you said. If you're getting earned media out of it, if you're speaking on stage or whatever, it builds profile, brand, presence. So it's kind of 360 for the founders and for yourselves as well, because you're investing in these businesses. Like, presumably just because you've invested in a business doesn't necessarily mean they'll make it to stage, right? Like, so, yeah. You know, if the business after a year, 2 years is struggling or whatever, it's not necessarily one you're going to showcase just for the sake of the fund, right?
No, 100%. And look, we're investing at pre-seed and seed stage. And most of the people that we have on the SaaStock stage, you know, they've built $100 million plus businesses. Yeah. So we look to see where we can help. Each conference, we've got our US coming up, and so when we have our portfolio companies saying, like, can we speak? And majority they don't, because it's just they're too early, right? But we look at other ways in which we can help them, and it's okay. Like, we'll sort you out a booth. You know, we'll connect you to the right people. Maybe we'll invite you to the speaker dinners. We'll get you on the podcast. You know, these sort of things.
Right? Yeah, there are kind of entry level routes that you can take. Let's move on, right? Because you launched Back Future ventures during a really challenging time, right? The tech market downturn. Silicon Valley Bank had literally collapsed, I think, you know, yeah. when we were first talking. And a real freeze in venture funding, right? So we're talking, what, this would have been 23, right?
Yeah.
So can you share some of your experiences and the key lessons that you learned raising a yeah. first-time fund during that kind of period of uncertainty?
Yeah, so I guess technically that's when we started to raise. It wasn't, let's say, the public launch as such, but pretty much, and I think it was one of the first checks and one of the first LP conversations that I had was with Tehi Nam, who's the managing director of Storm Ventures. Mm-hmm. And I was on the phone to him. You know, I think we'd sent him the deck, which had taken ages to get ready.
And Ken was already on the team at this stage?
You were already on the team.
Okay. So you were in early.
Okay. Yeah. And he said to me, oh, have you seen the news? You know, Silicon Valley Bank has collapsed. And I was like, oh, interesting. He said, oh, yeah, this is going to be very interesting times. Like, you know, generally for the market, yeah. but also for back future starting to raise. Having said that, you know, he committed to the fund, which was great. And I think, like, ultimately he was placing a bet on me and on us, and I'm grateful for that. But initially, actually, I felt like it hadn't, like what was happening in the market was not necessarily hampering us initially, but perhaps this was naivety, right? But we kind of got out of the gates, and I think, you know, we probably closed the first 25 LPs, you know, in the first sort of couple of months, right? What I was getting, and I think all you know, general partners or all people sort of raising, you know, when they're looking for LPs, like, you're always going to get a lot of no's, right? And I was getting frustrated with some of the no's because I knew I'd built relationships with these people for 10
years. People tell me, I've had founders who are now raising kind of funds telling me it's so much easier to raise as a founder than it is to raise as a GP.
Yeah.
Like, it's harder to raise yeah. from LPs than it yeah. is to raise institutional capital for yeah. your startup.
Yeah. I thought at the beginning it was actually the other way, sort right? of easy.
Yeah. yeah.
But it wasn't. And what I was seeing was that there was a lot of people that I knew very well with a lot of liquidity that were just saying, no, like, you know, we're holding on to this and, you know, given the market and it doesn't seem like tech's a great space and this is a very illiquid investment, that they weren't committing, right? So I think eventually, perhaps after that honeymoon period, even though whilst the markets weren't good, we started to see that it was becoming harder and harder. And we started to, you know, we were having conversation with funder funds who were finding it very difficult to raise themselves, right? And so it was certainly not the best of times. And then we were also seeing, you know, all over LinkedIn that a number of solo GPs or first-time funds that they were trying to raise, but they ended up like just stopping because it was very difficult. And especially for emerging managers and first-time funds, it perhaps was one of the worst times to go for it.
And I don't think, I think some of that stickiness has remained. I mean, I would argue that, like, you know, I know lots of people raising funds at the moment. It's a struggle, whether it's fund one or fund three, right? It's not an easy time to be out there raising. I mean, Ken, you had a bit of a giggle there over the deck. Like, one of the things that I find really interesting is, you know, I've had a lot of people come on this podcast and say to me, you know, we went out with a deck, but actually, you know, despite having a really kind of niche thesis, we'd have LPs coming back saying, we don't understand this. You need to, you know, make it more accessible, more understandable. Like, what was the journey in terms of the evolution of the thesis of back future? Because to some extent, I would have expected it to be relatively simple. SaaS stock, community, deal flow, co-investors, we understand SaaS, that's what we're doing, very, very kind of, you know, core niche. What was the sort of pushback you were getting on the deck? Or in general?
Well, I think it was just track record and
yeah.
the timing. But I think it was very clear from everyone that we spoke to that, you know, it's a conference and we're spinning out of it. I think in the beginning, there was very much a coupling of the SaaS stock brand with the back future brand.
Yeah.
But as we've kind of progressed this new deck, we're kind of decoupling it a bit to say, okay, like, this is standalone, but, you know, the USP is still there.
Yeah.
That's why we're saying it. But yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that before, like with, say, Founders Factory, Brent Hoveman's accelerator, First Minute Capital, which is, you know, one of the funds that you see seed funded, but like they are very, very separate entities. And there is, you know, it is not a given that if you are part of the Founders Factory Accelerator that you're going to receive follow-on capital or any capital from First Minute. It's just a standalone fund. And I think that's important, right? Like, I mean, you know, because there are two ways you could look at it. You could say, okay, everyone at pre-seed that comes to SaaStock will bung anywhere between a 10 to 50,000 check into, right? Like you could play the arbitrage game, right? Like you're just going to build a portfolio, basically become an asset manager, and you would expect that some of those bets are going to pay off, right? Or you could take the more VC sort of focus, but portfolio construction in terms of working towards power law to make it happen, right? But I guess, I mean, this kind of leads me to my, really the core question I want to ask you guys, if I'm honest, right? Like, is SaaS dead, right? Like you talked about love of learning, yeah, right? But with that kind of explosion of generative AI, no yeah. code tools, increasing product commoditization, is the traditional SaaS playbook still relevant today, right? So if I look yeah. at my own business, like we don't have a CRM. We've built that. Well, we have a CRM rather, but we've built that using low code tools. We've got yeah. Airtable, got you know, NAN driving workflows, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah. I'm seeing that more and more, right? Like I don't need to go and buy the $100 a month product. Yeah. I can quote unquote build it myself. So how do you see the kind of SaaS business model evolving over the next few years?
Yeah.
And you've also been quite vocal about changes in the SaaS landscape. Yeah. So are we moving towards a future dominated by highly capital efficient AI first SaaS businesses, or is there still space for that kind of more traditional heavily VC funded model?
I think it's a bit of both, with maybe more of a leaning to the latter and the AI first and the capital efficient. And certainly, let's say six months ago sort of plus, and there was a lot of clickbait you know online around SaaS is dead, mm. and then you listen to a podcast and then there was actually, this is not what we're really saying, but yeah. you know they're just picking out the clickbait from that. And certainly, like within SaaStock, you know, it's named SaaStock. There were, you know, people on the team that were sharing the clickbait and going, "Oh my God, do we need to, you know,
is SaaS dying? Should we pivot out of SaaS?
Do we need to be called AI stock or yeah. whatever?" Right? I'm not one to kind of like, you know, panic, and I'm sort of like quite calm to look into this, right? And so it's certainly something that I didn't ignore, but I think where I sit today, like I firmly believe that. SaaS is evolving. It's not dead. That AI is a great enhancer and tailwind into the SaaS industry.
It's a technology,
that's
right?
Breathing new life.
AI is a technology and SaaS yeah. is a business model.
Yeah, exactly. So it's making yeah. SaaS better. It's making SaaS products better. You talked about, and I think that's fair, and we'll see a lot of these use cases, like with yourself, that, okay, you're not paying Salesforce a ton of money. You built your own CRM using Airtable and low-code, no-code tools. But what are they? They're SaaS tools, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, and low-code, no-code has been around for ages. And now, like with AI, it's just kind of better that you can just build something, you know, whether it's an app or a website, you know, in one day. So I think now it's just got better. So all the new SaaS companies that are like born today are AI powered. They're AI first, mm. right? And they have the AI features, which is just going to, you know, create quicker, you know, wow moments and return on investment. And what we have is this legacy, pool of SaaS companies, let's say 30,000 or so, and some of them are 20 years old or 10 years old, that have to catch up.
Yeah.
And if they don't, you know, it's pretty much table stakes that they have to have AI in their product and figure that out, whether they have to rebuild their entire product stack and entire way of selling and so on to compete. If they don't do something, you know, they're going to become irrelevant, right? Mm. But I think it's an exciting opportunity. And what I'm seeing from most of these SaaS companies, and even like, let's say, some of the early movers, and I know it's kind of like an obvious one, but, you know, Intercom, they kind of had to, their customer service, you know, they had to jump onto it. And, you know, now they've built their, you know, Fin AI and so on, and they're all in on AI, right? And they've rebuilt their products, right, mm. in an AI first world. So what we're seeing is that SaaS is at the application layer. The application layer in AI is where all the money is going to be made. That's what everyone is saying. This is where all the investment is going in. So I think it's absolutely not dead. It's like new life has been breathed into this next generation of SaaS. And that model is still going to be around now, like the software as a service and, you know, pay monthly or pay annually.
That's changing.
We'll see, like, whether it's like, you know, consumption-based, more of that consumption-based pricing, I don't know, prompt-based pricing or whatever, right? We're going to see more models, but ultimately it's applications, it's software, and we're just going to have better products and more money in the market.
I mean, I think I saw a tweet or a Z or whatever they're called now. I've yet to figure that out. But anyway, that's a separate conversation for another podcast. But it basically was a really simple example, right? Which was, if you are building a business that uses AI to solve, for argument's sake, bills of lading, right? You are a logistics or a fintech company with AI. You are not an AI company, right? And I think that's the kind of point you're making. AI as the technology drives the product. The product is then sold in a manner that is software as a service, which is the business model, right?
Yeah.
So I think the problem is that a lot of people think about SaaS as either a technology or a vertical in and of itself, but it is a vertical within business models, but it is not a vertical in terms of application, right? And so I guess, Ken, like from your perspective, like how and you come from a fintech background, for example, right? Like, so how do you think that founders are going to really internalize this shift, right? And not think about it from we're building an AI company, but we're still, because I think that's part of the problem, by the way. I think like lots of founders are out there, we are building an AI company, but no, you're actually building a fintech or you're building a logistics or you're building a whatever company. So what we're seeing is obviously the spicy valuations happening within AI. So how do you think about that when you're talking to founders, especially those that are like presenting themselves as an AI company rather than
sensible?
Definition.
I think a preface is like betting on the horse and the jockey, right? You're still very much looking at the jockey and asking them why they're doing this. And depending what they're going after, is saying where a lot of success has been in the enterprise sales and SaaS. Mm. You know, just because you've built an AI application does not mean you're going to be doing, you know, enterprise sales, right? Because you talk about the procurement process. Are you experiencing that? Like security, there's so much to be considered there.
Going to your earlier point about Lovable, that's a problem. Like I can build up to here, but geez, like once you start thinking about environments, security keys, when you start thinking about security more generally, like it becomes difficult. You still need someone to build the kind of actual software actually can be shipped out, right?
Yeah. And that's what I think about, like, I guess personally about construction is like, you know, the application layer, that's like I said, there's really a lot of stuff that's going to go on there. But then what is the depth and stickiness of something like this? I mean, a first mover advantage is great. First mover advantage doesn't mean you're going to be the winner. If you choose to take some money off the table, as they go on, sure. But, you know, what's the core product that's going to be kind of sticky? It doesn't mean you have to have as large of a team as before, but I think a lot of the same principles will remain. But, you know, are we 10Xing everyone on the team? Probably not yet, but it's getting there. Continue to be more efficient, but I think a lot of the same principles will stay the same depending on the customers. There's an article I saw, just because we can have smaller teams, maybe SMEs are now viable to scale into as an ICP. But again, the same things still apply.
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a churn is going to remain the same, maybe higher. So it's still not going to be a smoothing out of revenue over time. So it's still going to be very unpredictable and,
my take is enterprise. Like when you are building a SaaS tool, the only market that makes sense is enterprise. Like bar a few very neat. Like, so if you think about highly transactional businesses like Xero or kind of, you know, companies that are ubiquitous, and like Xero only has 6% of the market. Let's not forget that. Like those make sense. I've tried to build in that space, and like SMEs, they're a pain. Like they are not very good customers to have on board, because they're probably like the most reluctant to pay, but also the most demanding, and they're so fragmented that actually, and so what, where I think the future is going is highly verticalized, highly niche, like really, really kind of single pain point solutions. Like to your point around, you know, do you buy a Salesforce or do you build yourself? Well, the reason we didn't, you know, we used to use HubSpot. HubSpot didn't do it for me because it couldn't capture what I needed to capture, but I can capture what I need to capture now using the tools that I'm using. And I think, you know, the best businesses that will be built over the next 3-5 years, or certainly 1-3 years, are going to be the ones that really look at a very, very hyper-localized niche and solve that really well, where there is still a market that's big enough. Because I think the other thing is, and I'd love to get your kind of take on this, is, you know, from my perspective, SaaS can be highly capital efficient, right? Like, I mean, it lends itself to non-dilutive funding. Like venture funding used to be kind of the fuel to drive marketing or whatever, but I think that's less relevant in a world where A, there is non-dilutive funding, but also you get product-led growth, et cetera, all the buzzwords. But I equally wonder whether founders today are going out looking for the venture style outcome. Because if you can build a business where you can own 80%, let's say, rather than 20%, and you can sell it for 100 million or even 50 million for that matter, like $40 million or pounds is pretty transformational, generational capital that you are building for yourself. Like, I mean, that is life-changing money, right? So I'd love to understand if you think you're going to see a shift in that direction as well.
I think 100%. I think the barriers to entry to build are lower than ever. And, you know, in the era of capital efficient, like VC companies are being told to be capital efficient, like effectively run like a bootstrap company, right? Why not run like a bootstrap company, but not, you know,
not take the money,
not take the money. And with that, like, you know, what is enough, right? You know, is it 10 million? Is it 30 million? Is it 40 million? Do you really want to build $1 billion business and
can you,
you know, own 10% of it? Can you? Because not many can't, right? I know like a lot of people that have built great bootstrap businesses that have incredible wealth, pay themselves a lot of money or have made a lot of money through exit. If I personally was doing it, that would be the path that I would do. But I think a lot more bootstrap companies are going to be born today, fewer VC backed. Whilst the VC market is a little bit hot again because of AI, I still feel that you're just going to see so many more bootstrap companies. And
I think there's going to be a huge amount of competition for VCs trying to get into the
very few
deals, right? Yeah. Which then begs the question, what happens, right? Like,
well, you're going to see probably fewer VCs. Fewer VCs, right?
You get into the VC winter. So let's move to, you know, we kind of talked about this a little bit in the quick fire. You know, COVID forced events online and then rapidly back offline. From your perspective, how did it impact SaaStalk? How did the shift impact SaaStalk? And how did that reinforce your thinking about the role of human connection?
Yeah, it was definitely an experience. And I think, like, yeah, we just kind of saw, obviously, within a space of a month, like, I think, you know, in February, seeing the news and, you know, COVID spreading, wondering what's going on, through to, I think, like, early March. Okay, you can't come back into the office anymore, right? Mm. Everybody worked from home. And we had that year, so this is 2020, we had SaaStalk conferences planned in Asia, in Singapore, in the US, in Europe, certainly those three. The Asian conference was not too far away. It was like a few months after us lockdown. And we could see that actually we were not going to be able to do any of the in-person events, right? And we had to cancel all the in-person events. We actually didn't get our money back, certainly from like we put the most money into the Asia conference. And that was where most of that money did not come back into the business. We'd also, you know, scaled up to the team. I mean, we were like 24 people at this point, and not really knowing, certainly for a moment, of like, what does this year look like? Like, what do we do? What is the plan? And I think just the initial moment, or that there was like, you know, this initial day when like all this shit was happening, was like, oh fuck, is this black swan event that I never thought of going to be the thing that kills my growing business, yeah. Right? And then whether it was the same day or the next day, I woke up and it's like, of course, I'm not going to let it kill the business, right? I've got responsibilities. I've got to figure out the way. And, we got together in a war room with, the leadership team, and we had like seven ideas of that we brainstormed together of like, what can we do? And the most obvious one was like, okay, we're going to go into virtual events. And then we just moved, you know, with our backs to the walls, like faster, than we'd ever been before, you know, with a clear plan. I think we were pretty much not the first to announce, because I think Web Summit, had announced that they were going to be doing, like, they moved one of their events to a virtual event. I don't know if it was strategic, but we put our virtual conference before their virtual conference. And so it was actually one of the first sort of globally from the startup big tech sort of sector to happen. And it was a relative success, but it was a revenue generator, right? You know, we sold tickets. We were figuring this out, and we used Hopin. We were one of the first customers of Hopin. I remember having the calls with Johnny, early on, and working with him to just help me figure this out. Yeah. Like, how do we price
how does it work?
What what does this mean? What's the value going to be? So we put together the first event. We were lucky again because this was. 6 years into our journey, that we had a customer base that was pretty loyal to us. We had, sponsors that didn't want to see us fail. Mm. And I think in some instances, some sponsors sponsored us because they just wanted to see us keep afloat.
I would also imagine that people wanted connection, right? Like, despite...
Yeah, there was a novelty in what we were doing. So there was curiosity. Yeah. People wanted connection because everybody was isolated. And look, I think the first SaaSDoc virtual conference was a success. And, we had feedback like, this is the gold standard of virtual events. It was also the first one, right? So that standard could have got better. And I think a lot of people learned from that, including other conferences. What we saw was it did provide connection to an extent, right? But ultimately, I mean, look, everybody got fatigued with the virtual events. It became like overwhelming. There was, 100 virtual events every day. So people got sick of it. And we realized that the real value, nothing beats face to face, right? And that probably this is the overarching takeaway through both, let's say, our delegates for the events and our sponsors, that it virtual was not beating face to face, right? So when we came back out of that, and when we came back into the first physical conference in 2022, everybody had a grin ear to ear, like 3,000 people, because they were happy to be back, happy to see each other again, happy to do business face to face, right? And now I think when we take even like that connection from virtual conferences and face-to-face in the AI world, that we're living in now, and everybody's, using all these AI tools to make themselves superhuman and, be efficient or whatever.
But becoming actually less human and less engaging as a result.
But I think what I'm seeing and what the sentiment is out there is that, okay, these AI tools are great, but still nothing is beating face to face. And a lot of sales, and certainly, the mid and enterprise level, is getting back to the golf course, is getting back to the steak dinners, and human connections are becoming even more important in a AI driven world.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it earlier, right? VC is a relationship game. Like, that's why the community aspect works. But not just venture. Like, I've built, like, everything I've ever built, everywhere I've ever worked has been a human to human connection. Like, there is nothing that, there is nothing that beats going, speaking to someone and doing a deal. Now, you can get partway there on Zoom for sure, right? But one of the reasons I do this podcast, no doubt one of the reasons you do your own, is because you can have a much more human personal conversation when you're sitting face to face with someone in a room. I mean, Ken, from your perspective, that kind of move from virtual back again, like, were you, so I guess one question is, were you an avid SaaS talk kind of attendee previously. Was that something that you kind of did before you joined Back Future?
No, I actually discovered SaaS.com. So there's local chapters.
Yeah.
So when I first came to London for my master's, I wasn't sure how long I was going to be here. Here we are 5 years later. But one thing I wanted to make sure I did was...
First of many Americans, I think, that are going to come over and spend some time in the UK.
Very timely. and, you know, I did it. I was like, I want to get into fintech and I want to have some experience in London and working. So I did an internship at this company called Shuttle. They do payment orchestration. Mm-hmm. And the CRO of that company, Nick Dunce, is the London City lead for that. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to understand like this whole ecosystem and what that was. And that was 2021. Mm. So yeah, I mean, about a few years of being understanding of it. And then there was a SaaS.com founder membership. I think, well, that was Christmas. So I was 22. So I helped out with that, booking that. And that's kind of where you really, really got to get involved with it.
Yeah.
So I've always been aware of it.
I mean, I guess the question I'd have is, you know, to me, what seemed like a sensible middle ground was like a number of, like, I would have imagined that the world would have evolved from like everything virtual to actually virtual was okay for some stuff. So let's do our core events live, but let's also have a virtual offering, right? But it seems like that didn't happen. I don't know if that was because the tools sort of closed down and we all kind of know what happened with Hopin, or if it was just felt like actually that, you know, people are more than happy to just keep coming in person. But like, I would have imagined, like, you know, so if you think about like TED and TEDx, right? Like, I'd have imagined you'd had a situation where you'd had your large events in person and live, but you'd have maybe had some more niche or separate events that could have been sort of at least quasi-virtual, if not fully virtual. But that didn't seem to happen. Was there just no appetite for that, do you think?
Look, I thought that was what was going to happen as well. When I first looked at Hopin, I think their timing was very good because this was just before COVID and just before lockdown. I remember like sharing it with the team and speaking with the team and saying like, this looks really good. Like, we can do the physical events, but we can have this virtual offering and this will be, you know, quite innovative. And we'll have people that can't maybe come to the physical events, maybe because of geography or certain abilities to do so, to get that audience as well. I just think people got fatigued and they realized that face-to-face was the best, that they weren't getting the real connections that effectively...
I think that's the big thing. Like, you can't have... So if I think about the value of an event, and I talk to a lot of people that go to, say, Slush, right? Yeah. They don't go to the events. It's like the dinners or the club nights or whatever, the party bits. And that's where you have the conversation. You can have a conversation with 10 people. You can't do that on a virtual.
Exactly. It's good conferences, good events provide meaningful conversations.
Yeah.
And you weren't getting meaningful conversations on virtual. So ultimately, it just ended up being more of a content media play.
Yeah, so you're sort of watching.
Yeah, and there is so much content and media out there anyway. So do you really need to do that? So I think like for us, and I'm sure like for others, realizing the real value comes at the in-person event, the meaningful conversations happen there. Let's focus on that, and you know, not distract ourselves with a virtual offering.
It makes a huge amount of sense. So look, just before we kind of wrap up, I have a couple of questions. One which I've been asking our guests for the last year or so, but another one that I've just sort of added in just to make it a bit more human. So the first one is: what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home?
I don't think I've got too many contrarian convictions. I don't want to be like a sort of like
I think the only contrarian conviction is that there are no contrarian convictions. Like my contrarian conviction.
I know, I guess personally I think as an American, I think being in Europe, I think the risk appetite on a lot of things and willingness to at least explore certain things at an earlier stage But I think that's just more regional.
Maybe our contrarian conviction is we've got an American and a Brit here that Ken thinks everybody's going to leave the US and that it's better in Europe at the moment. And I'm thinking, well, actually maybe it's better in the US than in Europe.
I am interested in that. Is very contrarian. Yeah. I would like to understand your thinking behind that at some point. I agree. Like, it's really, I've asked this question now a number of times, and I think you either get a very sort of stock answer or something that isn't really necessarily a conviction or is like so obviously off the wall that like, anyone's going to say that. But I think the problem is because we've we've had in the last sort of, you know, decade or so, certainly from the US, you know, you see it on Twitter, X all the time. Predominantly from a certain cadre of VCs, you know, who will just be really like line in the sand. This is my conviction. And it's performative. Like, you can tell that it's performative, right? And I think that's where we've gotten to, because I think having a conviction is one thing, but having a contrarian conviction and being right? Yeah. That's where the difficulty lies. So maybe the more human question, so that we can get to know the real yous, what is one thing that moves you the most emotionally, Ken?
I think just human interaction, truly. Like,
that is the least contrarian.
No, well, I mean, I guess what moves me emotionally, I wouldn't say that's the contrarian aspect, but
joking.
I spend most of my time I'd rather just have the time to get a call for someone. If we could probably do an initial 30-minute call, but events, coffees, like just having like the real interaction with anyone, skipping the pitch. Let's not do that. Let's just have a conversation.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you're laughing with people. I mean, like, first call you have with VC and a founder and you're laughing about something, you know, I think that's some of the best times. That makes it the most easiest way.
Yeah. Love it. Alex?
I think for me, like, I've got two daughters, and if I ever watch something which is like daddy daughter, like a movie, or, you know, parent sort of daughter, like it really gets to me.
Yeah.
And actually, I think my kids have never seen me cry, and they make a thing out of it. Because generally I don't cry. But I remember watching The Wild Robot in 3D with one of my kids.
Yeah.
And I found it a very moving movie, but I had the 3D glasses on, and there were moments where I was wiping away, like I was welling up, wiping away the tears. So my daughter didn't see it. But
honey, it's just I've got a little bit of a smudge on there.
Reaction to the 3D glasses. But anything like that just gets me.
It's interesting. I've found more recently that I'm being moved more by both music and movies and music in movies than I ever used to be. The sad thing for us is, I guess, you know, we're now at the stage where we're watching Game of Thrones with our daughters rather than, which can be quite uncomfortable, but no, I completely love that. And I think, you know, when you have young kids, having that ability to connect, especially when they're also so online, right? Like, having that ability to find something shared is really beautiful. Look, Alex, Ken, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. For our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to find you on the interweb?
For me, probably LinkedIn is the best place. So Alex Thumer, and you'll find me pretty active these days. So I'm kind of focusing there. I've kind of almost dropped X.
I'm getting close.
Yeah, for the moment. So LinkedIn, I need to do more on YouTube, but... like, I don't have my own channel. Like, everything is kind of going on the SaaS Talk channel on YouTube, so LinkedIn.
Okay, amazing. Ken?
Yeah, Kenneth Kashif Thomas, the only one on LinkedIn, so very easy to find.
We'll be putting the links in the show notes. Yeah, which
and Back Future Ventures, that's a LinkedIn page for that. Backfuture.vc.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.